Good morning, everybody. We are actually, I'm just going to open up my Gemara here. We're actually right at the top, I believe, of Yotzei Tzemach Aleph, exactly, of 18a. So good morning. Very briefly, what we did yesterday was we talked about two types of foods, one which was a Rishon and one which was a Sheni, combining with each other to act as a Sheni to create a Shlishi. And we talked about also all of the different shiurim that come up in various different cases and how Ochlin and Mashkin, foods and drinks, can combine with each other. And then the Gemara explained that because they come from the same source, that's why they can do that. But there are very, very, very many applications. Let's talk about today. Let's start with the next Mishnah. Okay, top of Yud Ches Amud Aleph. Points of introduction. Okay. Orla and Kilei Akarim. So I actually am in the process of preparing my Kashrut course for this year, which is actually a much smaller course than I'm preparing for. I'm preparing as if it was this massive course. But one of the things that I decided to do is to break down the course into, so it's about Kashrut, what's kosher and what's not kosher, is rather than to teach it in sort of a mixed up way or to follow the order of another Sefer, I said, let's be very, very clear about Kashrut. In Kashrut, there are things that are inherently not okay. Okay, there are things that are non-kosher. For example, a non-kosher animal, a pig, is not kosher. And then there are methods by which something non-kosher can contaminate something kosher. Okay, so for example, if pig was cooked together with something else, then that something else would become not kosher also. So I made a giant list of all of the original things that make something non-kosher. This includes rabbinic, this includes biblical, this includes all sorts of different things. Okay, so for example, Bishul Akum, things that are cooked by a non-Jew under certain circumstances are not allowed to be eaten. Okay, so that's something which is inherently non-kosher. Okay, and then I made a whole separate section of all of the different methods of transmission, all the different specifics of transmission, and bittul and taste and blias and all these different things. So here we have two of the things that may not be eaten, which are on my original list, although not that well-known, not that popular. First is Orla. Orla, hard to translate exactly what it means, but here's the situation which it refers to. Any fruit tree which grows, the Torah says, Shalosh shanim yelachem arelim lo yeachel. The Torah says you should leave your fruit tree arel. Arel means uncircumcised in Hebrew. So what do you think uncircumcised means when it comes to a tree?
Leave the fruit on the tree.
You leave the stuff on there. You don't snip it off. You don't take it off. So the first 3 years of any fruit tree, the fruit may not be eaten, period.
Or hana.
Well, yeah, we could talk a little bit about it. It's supposed to be burnt, whatever that means in the Torah. But yes, okay, you may not use the first. You should not be cutting off the, again, it's not necessarily the issue of cutting off this, or is, as you said, achila, hana. But first 3 years, nothing. Okay? Fourth year is something that's called neta revai. Okay? And the Torah says, yeh kol piro kodesh hilulim lashem. That fourth year should be brought to Yerushalayim, okay, brought to be eaten. Again, I'm not going into all the specifics of Netzer Avai, but that's the fourth year of fruits, and only Uvach Shanach Amishis, only on the fifth year, says the Torah, are you allowed to start using your tree's stuff. Okay, this is the laws of Orla, but again, Orla is those first 3 years where there's no heter whatsoever. Okay, there's no permission to eat any of that fruit or use any of that fruit. Okay, so that's Orla. Kilei Akarim is a... Oh, actually, I'm going to tell you something cool about Orla. We talk about modern applications. There is an opinion. So the question is, in Judaism, how do we define what's a tree versus something that grows from the ground? Okay, we have two different brachos, Borei Pri HaEitz, Borei Pri HaAdama. What if something, for example, has a woody stem? Okay, so biology has dealt with their definitions of fruits and vegetables. I don't know them, frankly. This is why I thank myself.
All the time.
They don't... Yeah. But that's my point. Meaning, but the Torah has a separate set of definitions. Okay? Some people say it depends on how often the plant breaks down and regrows. Okay? That's another point of definition that we use. So fascinatingly, depending on your definitions, you can end up, if you use more of the woody stem definition, meaning what is the stem made out of, there is, the post can point out, there is possibly a type of eggplant that is perpetually orla. How is it perpetually orla? Orla is supposed to be only the first 3 years. Well, this plant, within the first year or two, breaks down and regrows. And breaks down and regrows. And breaks down and regrows. So according to one minority opinion, there's this one type of eggplant that actually may never be eaten. Now, people are opposed to that on philosophical grounds. There's a philosophical argument saying God wouldn't create a food that he doesn't want humanity to eat, etc., etc. But that's a philosophical argument, and it may have merit. That's for a different discussion about eating things with bugs in them. God wouldn't create a food that now grows with only bugs in it that we can't eat it. Again, these are philosophical discussions, important discussions, halachic discussions. But this one case where we look at our definition of what's a tree, I just remember this one situation where something could perpetually be orla. I thought that was really cool. Mm-hmm. Okay, kilei hakerem. So the Torah talks to us about a category of different things called kilayim. Kilayim we generally translate as a forbidden mixture. What are some of the types of kilayim that we know of?
Grape and wheat.
Grape and wheat, which is one that we're talking about in our Mishnah. What are some other types of kilayim?
Well, again, linen and wool.
Very good. That's beged kilayim shadnez. The Torah specifically refers to that as kilayim as well. What are some other types of kilayim that we are not supposed to do? So certain types of crossbreeding, both biologically, both with animals, and grafting, right. Correct? Grafting fruits, okay? In many of these, the Torah says don't do any of these things, okay? The Torah says Eschu kosai tishmaru behem techalo tarbiya kilayim. So no animals being mixed together. You shouldn't make mixed breeds of animals. Okay. Sadchalot tizra kilayim ubeged kilayim shatnez lo yale alecha. So and we've got.
We even have an ox and some other animal pulling a cart together. Isn't there something?
Yes, there is something like that.
Yeah.
It's not particularly. It's a good point. There's different interpretations of why that law is. There is very different interpretations.
Is that kilayim?
No. I don't believe we call it kilayim unless you specifically mate them. Okay, unless you specifically mate them, I don't believe it's called kilayim. It may be to avoid kilayim. It may be there are other reasons given because they pull at different speeds and then one is causing the other one pain.
So a mule is kilayim?
Yes, precisely. A mule is kilayim. And there's many midrashic ideas, by the way, about why a mule is so bad. And anyways, because it can't have children and different things. There's all sorts, exactly. There's all sorts of midrashic. But anyways, it gets back to ultimately, there is this category of things called kilayim. And generally, they're a mixture of two things that for some reason should not be mixed together. Okay, some people say it's because it's not our job to interfere with the way God created the world. Again, there's very nice ideas behind this stuff. People bring this up all the time for genetic modification. Is it appropriate to modify genetics of foods? Is it appropriate to modify genetics of humans? These are big ethical issues, but a lot of them get back to what we think is wrong with kilayim. If we think kilayim is a chok, it's something without a reason, and the Torah begins, by the way, et chukotai tishmaru. If we think it's just without reason, God said this, okay, so that doesn't give us any ethical parameters for what we should or shouldn't be doing. That doesn't fall under the technical violation of kilayim. But again, these are big, big issues. One of the types of kilei hakerem, again, other than shatnez, which again is the wool and linen mixed together, it's a beautiful idea about that relating to Cain and Hevel. Right? The Midrash says, what did Cain bring? He brought flax. And what did Hevel bring? Sheep, wool. And there's something, you know, we sort of keep those things separate. Okay? Very nice. But one of those types is something called kilei hakerem, which says that we may not plant grapes near, again, certain other types of plants. Okay, and it's called the kilayim of the vineyard. That is the most severe type of kilayim. That is the most severe type of kilayim. And again, for the parameters of this, we can go elsewhere just to bring in the general idea. This is most severe in that other types of kilayim. For example, clementines. Clementines, I don't think, are naturally occurring, or tangerines, or all these ones. They're a result of some grafting somewhere along the way. We don't say that we can't eat those because they were grafted. Grafted fruits we're allowed to eat. Okay, we cannot do the grafting necessarily, depending on specific circumstances, but nothing wrong with eating them. Kilei hakerem, on the other hand, where you've got grapes mixed in with, again, wheat and other types of fields like that, in very close proximity, we actually are forbidden from eating it. Okay, again, same idea. It's very similar to orla. It's compared in many ways. Language is the same, and again, we're told there's a real ban on this. So, says the Mishnah, ha'orla v'kilei hakerem, orla, both the fruits of the first 3 years, which cannot be eaten, and kilei hakerem, when you've planted, again, your vine, your grapes, too close to grain.
The other way around. It's planting grain.
Correct. Really, kilei hakerem is when, planting grain too close to your vineyard. Yeah. I mean, it applies equally in both directions. Mitzarfin zeh, I believe. Mitzarfin zeh im zeh, they combine with each other, meaning in terms of just as we saw, Rashi says, just as we saw by Pigel and Nosar. Even though these are technically two different averos, again, having in them in combination, even if you didn't have enough of each to be mechayev you, you would still be chayev if you had them in combination. Okay? Rabbi Shimon Omer, Rabbi Shimon says, in mitzarfin, they do not combine with each other. Okay, so this is a machlokes, whether they combine or not, like we saw in other places. The Tanakhama says they combine with each other, and if you had half of this and half of this, you would be chayev, you'd get your malchus. The other one says, Rabbi Shimon says, they do not combine. Asks the Gemara, one second, this is a big problem. Umit tzarech Rabbi Shimon l'tzirufi? Does Rabbi Shimon need to combine them? V'hatanya, but we learned in a brayso, Rabbi Shimon omer, kol shehu l'makos. There is an opinion of Rabbi Shimon elsewhere, very fascinating opinion, okay, that in this case, Rabbi Shimon is of the opinion, and it may even be for other eatings as well, that Rabbi Shimon is of the opinion that even if you eat the smallest possible amount, you still get malchus. Again, unlike the traditionally accepted opinion, where you have to eat a kezayit of something in order to violate the law and get lashes, Rabbi Shimon is of the opinion, no. In Malchus, he says, no. Even if you eat a teeny tiny amount, you ate a speck of it, then you get malchus. Now again, you'd still need the hatra, and you'd still need the whole process of warning and witnesses. But ultimately, he says, the amount that you have to eat is not a kezayit. So he says the Gemara, this whole idea doesn't make sense at all. Rishimon, what do you mean he says they don't combine? For him, as soon as you eat one speck of it, you're chayef. How could they possibly combine?
Does that apply to everything, or just orla and kilayim that he says?
If I remember, I didn't look this up. It's Igmar and Makos. If I remember correctly, it was his opinion for other things as well. Does anybody have a note in the art scroll or something like that?
I didn't see it.
If I had a Makos, we can go look it up afterwards.
This is the data show Rav Shimon Shir Kzaslemer Elalein Chiyu Korban.
But for what? I assume for everything. Any Isser, right? It says any Isser? Yeah, okay. So it's for anything.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, in Malchus 17a it says, cannot be referring to liability of Malchus because even the minutest amount of either one by itself
suggests. So
right, no, his question was just whether this is about Orlan Kilei HaKerem or not, but I believe it's for all types of prohibitions.
And he's rejecting the shear.
Correct. No, he's not rejecting the shear. He says the shear is this, and the shear of Kezias is only for a korban.
He's liable to malchus for eating even a minute amount of a prohibited food.
Yeah, okay. So I think that's our conclusion. Okay. So ask the Gemara, Vatanya Rabbi Shimon Omer, but we learned in a Braita that Rabbi Shimon says, kol shehu lemakos, that the amount in order to get lashes is a kol shehu, in which case, what do you mean that they are mitzdarif? Okay. Says the Gemara, Tini, you're right. Instead, teach, not in mitzarfin, they do not combine, but in tzrichin litzarif, you do not need to combine them. Why? Because even as soon as you eat in a little bit, you get malchus. I'm curious. I didn't look into this. Again, I didn't have, still catching up. I'm going to be very behind for the next while, so I'm not going to be as thorough in my preparation.
Sorry.
But I was just curious why we don't say that. It's for the purposes of the korban?
He gives an example here, but I don't think it's that side. He says, "Hainu shalokim kolechad mehem epei b'pnei atzmo shein tzuchim shir kazayit lemalkot."
Correct, but you do need a shir kazayit for a korban.
The ain kavana of Mishnah ain mitzorfin lewarshe ain lokim al tzirufam ela lahefach.
Correct. I get the Gemara perfectly. I have no problem with the Gemara. Yeah. I'm just curious if we could have also similarly answered that the Mishnah is talking about for a korban.
Yeah.
In which case they could still be arguing.
Yeah.
But the Gemara doesn't answer that ultimately, I guess, because this is a preferable answer. Okay. Yeah. Next Mishnah. More background here. So, yesterday we talked about Tumat Tahara and. Aviavos atoma, avatoma, rishon latoma, how it transmits. This is relevant. Okay, we talked mainly about food and drinks yesterday. If you look back at the chart, which you printed out so nicely, if you don't mind for a second, or I can put it up on the screen again, but there's the chart, right? Can you read out the list? Oh, wow, so many people have the chart here. Thank you. Can you read out the list of Avos HaToma, of Avatoma? What's on there?
It says,
touch a dead body.
Yeah.
Dead sherets.
Yep.
Vela, Zav.
Very good. Zav, Metzora.
Metal utensil that touches Avatoma.
Okay. So we were talking about the ones for which touching. Now, there are many, just like with kashrut, there are many things which are inherently kosher, and there are many ways by which they can contaminate other things. So too with Toma and Tahara. There are things which are inherently Tameh, and there are many ways in which they transmit. Okay? In particular, if you look in the Torah, when it comes to a Zav, okay, as well as possibly other types of Tumos which come out of one's body, a Zav is someone who has some sort of discharge that's not a normal discharge, and has it on consecutive days or 3 days in a row, or and this causes that the person is considered to be Tameh. Same thing, by the way, for a woman, there's a concept of Zava, where she has a discharge also that's abnormal in some form or fashion. Again, I'm not here to discuss the specifics. We have Mesechtos in the final Seder of Shas in Taharos, which deal with Zavim. And Nida deals with a lot of the laws of Zava. Very relevant for the laws of Nida nowadays, interestingly. Not Zav, but Zava. But anyways, this is what a Zav is. Now, a Zav has many different methods of transmitting Tuma. Okay? And in general, there are different methods. We always think of the method of touching. Okay? We always think that's what we're trained to think. Why? Because we're talking about things coming into contact with other things. However, that's not the case. There are many, many other ways in which Tumah is transferred from one thing to another. In particular, the one that we care about now is a Zav or other Tameh person and their ability to sit on something. Sitting on something, it becoming a seat for them, is not because they touch it. Okay? Not because they touch. If they touch something, okay, that's a separate law. But there is a form of Tumah which is transmitted by it being a seat, what we call Tumat Moshav. Okay, there are other types of Tumah. There's Tumahs by carrying, there's Tumahs by leaving things in certain places, there's Tumahs, again, all these Tumahs exist. The one that we care about is when something becomes a seat for someone else. Yes?
So I have to go ask the question, then I have to go, unfortunately. Okay.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry.
So the sitting presumably is not because, it has nothing to do with touching. So if there's anything interposed, it's
correct,
still an issue. So like my question is, if you touch something and you're wearing a glove, does that count as touching?
It's a good question. I don't know the answer for Tomas and Taras.
In this situation, you could be sitting on it, and there could be two towels in between.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Okay. I believe so. But anyways, we'll have to go into more detail of it when you come back, or we can continue by email. Creating a surface. Now, also relevant, something we didn't discuss yesterday, is, let's say, for example, a fruit. Can a fruit just become Tameh if someone Tameh touches it? So we assumed yesterday, of course it can. We didn't talk about this concept called Hechsher Tumah. Hechsher means preparation. Really, for all...
Brian, we'll take care of the chair, don't worry.
Make sure Ralph gets it.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. There is this concept, again, also in Tumah Tahara called Hechsher, which means preparation for. It's interesting how the word Hechsher now means something else, but Hechsher means preparation for, and things cannot just become Tameh just magically by themselves. In order for something to become Tameh, it has to have undergone some sort of process which prepares it or allows it to become Tameh if contacted with something Tameh. Okay? Hechsher. That's, for foods, for fruits, for example, if it's water comes into contact with it, then it's Huchshar Lekabel Tumah. If Tumah would then come onto it, then it would become Tameh. When it comes to different materials, okay, so clothing, etc., what types of tumas can clothing have? They can have zav and zava and mitzora. Obviously, there's a concept of tzara'at habeged, but there are certain sizes that they need to be. Okay, let's see. So, if you learn taharos, you will learn that habeged. Okay, and here we're basically going to rely very heavily on Rashi. Habeged. Shumitame gimel etzbaos al gimel etzbaos. All good? So, the beged normally, in order to become tame, needs to be, you can look up, 3 fingers by 3 fingers, okay? This is 3 fingers, 3 square fingers, meaning the width of each finger. Etzba is listed on the very beautiful chart that you handed out. They say each etzba is 0.728 inches, or 0.019 meters, okay? So, 1.9 centimeters. That's what he gives. Again, I don't know what the rabbinic measurements are. My guess is based on the amount that they have for an amma, it's not that far off from Rav Chaim Naya's shir. But anyways, the etzbaos, okay, again, are very relevant in rabbinic literature. But if you've got 3 etzbaos by 3 etzbaos of of beged, which again is a regular woven garment, out of, let's say, wool.
So it's less than that, it doesn't get the tummy.
Less than that, it doesn't get tummy. Right. Okay, sackcloth, which is a different type of garment. Says Rashi, Shi'uro Dalet Tfachim al Dalet Tfachim. That, actually, 4 handbreadths, a much larger amount, 4 of these, okay, by 4, that's the smallest amount for which it becomes tame traditionally. Okay, next one. Okay, Ha'or, if you look in Rashi, Chamisha al Chamisha, 5 Tfachim by 5 Tfachim. Hamapatz, which is some sort of reed, woven reeds or something like that, yeah. 6 by 6.
So
six by shirt, six. It's just a shirt out of reeds. A shirt out of reeds, yeah. The point is here we're looking at the material, right? I mean, because all of these materials can be made into anything. But we're talking about just a piece of the material, okay? So again, the baguette, which is 3 fingers by 3 fingers, and then all the other types, which are 4, 5, and 6 handbreadths. Tfachim, okay, these are their normal amounts. Says the Mishnah, habeged vehasak, the baguette, which is the smallest one, the cloth, and the sackcloth, Hasak vehaor, the sackcloth and the hide. Haor vehamapatz, the hide and the, again, the woven reeds. Kulan mitstarfin ze im ze. They each combine with the other. Rashi notes the way that it's set out. It doesn't just say habeged hasak vehaor vehamapatz. It doesn't just give a list of all of them. It says beged vehasak, hasak vehaor, haor vehamapatz. The reason for that is because they each combine, like we saw previously, leniently. Kulan mitstarfin ze im ze. They all are lenient, meaning if, in this case, the more lenient one is to look at the larger of the two. Meaning, if you have the one that's 4 together with the one that's 5, so you need to create something that's 5. Okay, that's what Rashi says is the purpose of this. They combine to be lenient, not to be stringent. So if you had made out of the material that's 4 and the material that's 5 and it was only 4.5, that would not accept Tumah, that would not receive Tumah. However, if it was 5 or larger, meaning again, if the combined garment was larger than the required amount for the more lenient of the two garments, then it would, in fact, accept Tumah, again, if it was exposed to Tumah. Good. Says the Mishnah, okay, again, Kulan mitzarfin, all of them combined, ze im ze, this with this. Amar Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Shimon says, Matam, what's the reason why they combine? Mipnei shehen ru'uyin, because they are fitting, litame bimoshav, because they are fitting to become tame bimoshav, says Rashi. Okay, and this is a very, there's lots of mess in this Rashi of taking out words. Mipnei kshiyesh bein kulan shiur echad, ruyin l'tamei moshav. Hilkach mitzarfin. It says, when they all combine, meaning even if you were to combine all of them to one amount, you could have them become tamei by moshav. Meaning because they all have the tamei of moshav, so if you made a very large one out of all of the different kinds, okay, if you made a 6x6 out of all the different kinds, they would become tamei. That's why they combine. Okay, because they all have the same tumah, because they're all materials which are used for cloth and otherwise. Okay. Says the Gemara. Yeah.
So, if you have something that's smaller than the minimum amount, but you have 2 of them, the same thing?
No, neither of them, unless they're connected or sewn together,
okay.
Then they are too small to each individually get tumah. It's not about the total amount, it's about what it can service us for. Meaning these amounts, if you look, I believe, in Taharos, lots of times it's always, we're trying to figure out, and we're going to see this in the Gemara right now, we're trying to figure out what use does it has. Okay, if it's unusable, if it's such a small amount that's unusable, or unusable in certain ways, then maybe it doesn't accept Tumah if it's not being used in that form or fashion. Says the Gemara, Tana, we learned in a Braita. Kitza mikulan shlosha. Okay? If you cut from all of them, okay, and says Rashi, okay, a grand total of 3 by 3, 3 tefachim by 3 tefachim. Okay, Rashi switches to tefachim here. Ve'asa mehen beged lemishkav, and you made a garment. You made out of them a garment, lemishkav. Shlosha. Then the amount that you have to make in order for it to become tameh is 3 tefachim by 3 tefachim. Okay, that's what Rashi says. Okay, next. Where did I see 3 tefachim? Why am I saying tefachim? Maybe it's not 3 tefachim. I don't know why I said 3 tefachim. I, for some reason, thought that I saw tefachim here, but I don't see it now. Okay, so the amount is 3, either fingers or tefachim. Trying to remember why I'm saying tefachim. See if I can find it here on the side. Well, we have...
It says in our English translation, 3 tefachim by 3 tefachim.
Okay. I remember seeing that. I don't know where... I presume the reason why I'm thinking that is because it goes 3 to 1, down to nothing. So it's probably an order of size. So 3 must be larger than 1 as opposed to 3 fingers, which would be less than a tefach. Slightly less. Okay. So, kisa mikulan shlosha. So, if you cut little pieces of all of them, the asar mehen beged, and you made them into a garment, lemishkav, to lie on, okay, the amount is shlosha. Okay, there you need 3 tefachim. That would be large enough to be considered tameh in that case. Lemoshav, if you made it to be sitting on, tefach, it's actually just 1 tefach, that's the size. La'achiza, and if you combine them together to use it to hold something, says the Gemara, kol shehu, it's any amount and it can become tameh. Meaning, depending on what purpose it was processed for and it was created for and manufactured for, that will be the amount of which this combined garment needs in order to become tameh. Okay? Says the Gemara, right? La'achiza kol shehu. My la'achiza, what does it mean if you use it to hold something? Like, what do you mean to hold something? So, like, I'm using it as a glove? Like, what's happening? Okay? Amar Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish says, Amar Rabbi, that Rabbi Yanai says, Shekein omed linavla, because it is fitting for use in a navla. Navla means they used to use it while they were weaving in some form or fashion in order to, again, Rashi talks about it over here. Okay, likroch al etba'o kesha oreg umat v'achutin v'navla hi ariga. He says it's something you'd wrap around your finger while you were doing the weaving. Maybe you didn't want your fingers to get hurt by the wires. You're constantly moving them. So it was like a Band-Aid, basically. So even though that's a very, very small amount, not even 1 tefach by 1 tefach, since it was produced in order to have this use, and it is usable for this use, to wrap around your finger, then it's totally fine. Even the smallest amount possible of this combined beged would be able to become tameh. B'masnis tana, okay, and it was taught also elsewhere, ho'il v'ra'oi lekot seite'enim, since it's fitting for those who would cut figs. Again, fig cutting, I guess, again, maybe you didn't want your fingers to get dirty or you didn't want them to get hurt. So again, there were these little things that you'd put on your fingers. And so even though it's the size of literally a thimble, doesn't matter, it still can be mekabel tuma in that case. I should reiterate, okay? Being able to be mekabel tuma and being mekabel tuma are two different parts of the process. It actually has to be exposed to tuma in one of the mishkav, moshav, etc. ways in order to actually become tuma. It's just a question of what can become tuma when exposed to tuma in that manner. But with this, Hadron Allah Kachem Izbeach, we've finished now this final Mishnah in this last perek. We now continue on to the next perek with what's probably, I was listening to Shir, and they said, probably could have been the first Mishnah of the Masechta, this next Mishnah. Okay, any questions on that last stuff that we learned? Okay. Hanene mina ekta shavet. Yes.
I totally overslept. If you can just let me know where you're at the moment, that would just be helpful. Okay,
so you must have come in literally as I finished my last sentence, because we just said Hadron Allah Kachem Mizbeach. We've just finished on Daf Yud Ches, Amud Aleph. We've just finished the parak, literally.
Oh, okay.
So you're at the perfect starting point. You're at the perfect starting point.
Starting the new parak. Okay.
Yes. Right. So Hanena Min HaHektish Shavapruta. Hanena, one who benefits Min HaHektish from, again, something sanctified, Shavapruta, the amount that's worth a pruta. A pruta is a very small coin. We did the calculation years ago in the Kolel, it's a few cents. Afal pi shelo pagam, even though you didn't damage the object itself, meaning even though you only got benefit from the object, but you didn't actually cause a loss in the object itself, says the Mishnah, ma'al, you have violated me'ila divrei Rabbi Akiva. These are the words of Rabbi Akiva. This Mishnah is dealing with what actually is the transgression of me'ila. We've talked about the objects which are the transgression of me'ila, but we haven't talked about the action of me'ila so much. Okay, so says Rabbi Akiva, the first opinion in the Mishnah, it's about benefit, not about damage to the object. So if you have an object, and you benefited from the object, crown. You wore the crown, beautiful crown. Everyone thinks you're fantastic, what a beautiful crown you're wearing. So you benefited, one sheva pruta's worth from that object, you're chayev. Even though the crown is as beautiful as it was before, nothing got chipped, nothing got, it didn't go down in value in any form or fashion, I'm not sure whether or not that's true, but anyways, this is the opinion of Rabbi Akiva. V'chachamim omrim, however, the sages disagree, they say no. Kol davar sheyesh bo pigam, any item in which there is the possibility of a loss in the item, meaning there is depreciation when the item is used, lo ma'al ad sheyifkom, there's no me'ila until the person actually causes that depreciation. V'she'ein bo pigam, however, if it's something which does not depreciate, okay, and we're going to have to be a little bit generous with the definitions here. Obviously, everything can depreciate to some degree. The question is whether or not that usage would depreciate it. But, okay, and the Chachamim say, v'she'in bo pegam, those which don't, again, generally depreciate with use, kevan shenehene, as soon as you had benefit, again, of a shava pruta, ma'al, you did me'ila. Ketzad, says the Mishnah to explain the Chachamim's opinion, natna katla, bitzavara, if you put a necklace, okay, on a neck, tabas biyada, or you put a ring on someone's hand, or shasa bikos shel zahav, or you drank out of a golden cup, kevan chenehene ma'al, according to the rabbis, those things don't normally depreciate with use. A golden cup normally does not depreciate with use, a necklace normally does not depreciate with use, etc. Tabas, a ring, normally does not depreciate with use. Therefore, as soon as you benefited one pruta's worth, you did me'ila. However, lavash b'chaluk, if you wore a shirt, kisa b'talis, you covered yourself with the talis, bika b'kardom, or you used basically
cut with an axe.
Cut with an axe, yeah. Kardom, usually we also say is something that you dig with.
Yeah.
So it can spade be maybe a spade. Yeah, usually we translate it as a spade. You dug into the ground with a spade. Then lo ma'ala chiyifkom. Then you didn't do me'ila until you actually caused a depreciation of the item, since these items, right? Since these items normally depreciate upon use.
So if you wear a necklace mm-hmm. that's hektish, let's say.
Yep, precisely.
How do you define a pruta's worth of benefit?
So we're going to have to discuss that. This is precisely what's discussed. Right over here in the Gemara and in the Mefarshim. Okay? Take a look, right? Vehechi misharin anbehu Rashi, I'll tell you it's Rashi, it's about, you see Rashi in the beginning of the wide lines, Hanana afal pish lapagamal?
Yeah.
Jump down about seven lines. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Okay, see the word misharin anbehu?
Yeah.
Okay? So asks Rashi, right? Vehechi misharin anbehu, how do we figure this out? Precisely your question. Hachi. This is as follows. Omdin, we estimate, meaning we actually check out. Kama rotza isha litain. How much would a woman want to give? How much would a woman want to pay? Sheyish alu tachshitin kahalalu. That she should be able to borrow these types of beautiful things. Okay, so a woman is walking with a necklace. If someone would say, to walk with that necklace, I'd pay $1 million. Okay, so that has $1 million of value. So they say, what about to wear it for 1 second? For 1 second, I'd pay 30 cents. Okay, what about this other thing? I think that ring is ugly. I wouldn't pay anything for it. Then you haven't crossed that threshold. Okay, so that says Rashi, this is the way that we do it. Okay, and again, Rashi says, "Sheishul tachshitin kalalu leholich." Lalich on the Beis HaMishteh to go out to a bar. Beis HaMishteh is, I think, best translated as a bar. But because literally it's a place, it's a house of drinking. Yeah. Anyways, the point is, again, we have methods where we figure out what society would ascribe value to wearing these garments for this, well, not garment, but wearing these pieces of jewelry. Again, generally we're saying metal doesn't generally depreciate, but clothing would. Okay, so that's the opinion here. And finishes the Mishnah. Okay. Hanehane min hachatas. Okay. Hanehane min hachatas, one who benefits from hachatas. Kishihi chaya, when it's living, lo ma'al. You do not violate mila ad sheyifkom until you damage it. Kishihi meta, but when it is dead, kevan shenehane, as soon as you benefited, ma'al, you did mila. We'll talk a little bit more about this tomorrow in the Gemara. Shkoyach.